There are words that are fascinating because they seem to describe reality in a very profound way. Words like illicit that can have various connotations. For one thing, it simply means illegal, as in forbidden by law. At the same time, the word illicit can describe the grey areas of human activity, such as in shady deals involving goods of questionable provenance. And yet, when it comes to policymaking, law enforcement, or judicial verdicts, the world seems to work largely in a two-way system. Illegal activities and criminals on one side, law-abiding citizens on the other. And then there are those who bravely enforce law and order. They are the ones that books and films are about. And yet, this is nothing but a convenient look through a well-fitting pair of glasses. The real world is usually much more complex than this stark contrast of black and white that we have come to know from classic primetime movies. That is precisely why the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, SWP, has brought together an international group of researchers for a publication on what they call illicit flows. They have set out to examine more closely the many shades that emerge on the crossroad of what we tend to define as clearly opposing forces, good and evil. Their goal is to better understand the connections between the illegal and the legal world. They want to find out where and how the licit intertwines with the illicit, and what key factors are driving the many markets involved. When global crime is investigated, this normally happens with a clear focus on both a specific area as well as on the illegal activity itself. This current undertaking is guided by a more holistic and non-judgmental approach. The key findings will be published in 2021. Geographies of the Illicit, Sectoral and Spatial Dimensions of Illegal Markets Linking the Global South and Europe. Edited by Günther Mayhold, Melanie Müller, Judith Vorrath and Daniel Brombacher. This podcast presents some of those involved and the current state of their research. My name is Anne-Kathrin Thüringer and I will be your guide on this truly global tour. Welcome to Illicit Flows. Our first speaker is Mark Shaw, director of the Global Initiative Network. He previously worked for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime for 10 years and has published more than 20 books on organized crime, investigating various aspects of it for decades.
The topic of illicit markets, I would argue, began to emerge as a key issue in the 1990s. Of course, there had been illicit markets and organized crime before then, but the degree to which illicit markets have grown is really a feature of the global economy accelerating. Illicit markets are, if you like, the underside or connected to licit markets, and there's a crossover between the two of them. So as the global economy grew, the data that we have around illicit markets shows this very clear acceleration from around 2000. So in the wake of the end of the Cold War, there's a sense that organized crime is growing. And very much the terminology there is organized crime, because it's defined by established criminal groups, the Italian mafia, Russian organized crime, etc. But the debate begins to change, I would argue, in the 2000s, where you sense this enormous growth in a plethora of illicit markets. So not only the standard ones that you would ordinarily think of, illicit narcotics, for example, but also wildlife crime, oil, gold, people. The list is almost endless. Illicit markets have surged in the last 20 years because they rely on the instruments of globalization, whether that's growing trade, whether that's the growth in the internet. They are embedded, if you like, in the legal economy, and they use the sinews of the legal economy to be effective. And indeed, in many cases, they cross over with the legal economy, including in how they invest their profits. Of course, illicit markets, I think we should be clear, are what states say is illicit. And so a lot of the debate around illicit markets is how do you regulate the illicit or what you might call grey markets, because not everything is illicit in the same country. And so illicit markets or dealing with the issue of illicit markets is a much more complex undertaking than it first appears. It's not only about empowering law enforcement and prosecuting individual criminal entrepreneurs. A lot of the discussion around illicit markets and how to respond to them is in fact about the harms they cause. And understanding harm, what is the harm that is caused, and attempting to achieve a balance of harms and attempting to make sure that the response to the illicit market, and this is the old discussion around drugs and the war on drugs, which I think most listeners would know very well, is that our response should not cause greater harms than the market itself. The reality is that illicit markets are such an enormous partner of the global economy that we can't necessarily arrest our way out of the issue. We have to change the incentive structures. We need to understand illicit markets much more clearly. We should not draw boundaries around the impacts of illicit markets because the impact is global. We should all be concerned.
When we talk about the war on drugs and how to fight it, we tend to forget that not so long ago, the West actually earned a good deal of money with illicit substances. And at the time, this was completely legal. Some 150 years ago, Great Britain was the biggest drug dealer in the world. The East India Trading Company was not only one of the largest multinational corporations of its time, it had also secured the monopoly on trading opium from India to China. By the late 1800s, it had supplied around 15 million junkies in the Chinese Empire. Back then, the East India Trading Company relied on the fact that India was a weak and corrupt state, ideally suited to become a steady and dependent producer of the drug. In China, British imperial officials made sure that demand was ever growing and never went without supply. One can only guess how many Chinese addicts were actively created by the steady professional flux of this highly addictive drug. Today we tend to view the drug business as something fueled by a corrupted so-called third world afflicting the otherwise enlightened West. However, this brief view back on a not-so-distant past reveals that the trafficking of drugs between producer and consumer markets started out in a very different way. While those in charge of the production are not British officials anymore, the motives driving local farmers to grow poppy instead of crops are essentially the same as back in the 19th century. Our next speaker, Daniel Brombacher, is a drug trade expert at the GIZ, the Deutsche Gesellschaft für internationale Zusammenarbeit, on behalf of the German Federal Ministry for Economic Cooperation and Development, BMZ, and head of the Global Partnership on Drug Policies and Development, GPDPD. He takes a closer look at the less perceived parts of the global narco value chain.
The global drug economy consists of a huge number of illicit value chains spanning around the globe. But what we see mostly and what is perceived from it is only its visible parts of that illicit value chain. What is quite visible in the case of plant-based drugs is the cultivation of those drugs, because it's illicit agriculture and it spans out in the territory, so you can see it from the air. So coca plantations or opium poppy or cannabis are easy to detect. At the same time, what is very visible for us is drug consumer markets or retail markets that you can find, for example, in major cities like in Berlin. There are citywide famous drug retailing hotspots like Görlitzer Park, where also the drug economy becomes visible. But most of actually what connects the retail markets and the production sites is unknown because it's clandestine. It's hidden in containers, it's hidden in submarines, it's hidden in boats, in airplanes, maybe in the stomach of so-called drug mules. So that is not really visible. Usually what we look at is we count, and that happens around the world, we count how much hectares are under cultivation for illicit drug crops. But we do not look at why do people actually grow. Very often, if you just look at the plant, you just fight the plant, but you do not consider the socioeconomic conditions, poverty, lack of access to markets. We forget about those factors and we would like to shed light on it. the traditional belief in global drug policy making was, okay, we have source countries and we have consumer countries. So coca is coming from South America and cocaine use is happening in North America and in Europe. That's no longer true. We have huge consumer markets now also very close to the regions of origin. For example, Brazil is considered to be the second biggest cocaine market in the world after the US. We have huge cocaine markets all over the region. For example, in Asia, we have big opium consuming communities in some of the source countries. We do no longer have that black and white picture we had formerly. At the same time, we also see that a few European countries are major source countries for synthetic drugs and are also providing the whole world. So the global drug economy has become more interconnected and is not only following a south to north scheme, but also vice versa, and very often also south-south illicit value chains where the demand for illicit drugs in developing countries is also fulfilled by developing countries. And that's why also response needs to be more diversified and adapted to that situation.
Illicit flow.
So in dealing with an extremely diversified global market, any one-dimensional approach would not be fit to solve the puzzle. Thinking along the lines of clearly divided production and consumer countries, or even in more abstract terms like licit or illicit value chains, will not serve to find solutions to the multifaceted problems. Rather, the question, who is causing harm and who is suffering from it, are pointing in the right direction. Yet even those are not easily answered. Our next illicit flow is something entirely different. When we go to museums in London and Berlin, marveling at impressive artifacts from an ancient past, we focus only on part of the stories that lie behind them. While we know what could easily be found out about these cultural goods that we see on display, we rarely talk about how all of this actually ended up here. How did the mummy travel to England? Who of the rightful cultural owners consented to their nation's heritage being taken abroad? Illegal trafficking of cultural goods is an ongoing process with a long history. Yet, it was the recent wars in Iraq and Syria, the destruction and subsequent looting of historical sites, that have led to a new awareness, not only of the illegal nature of the business, but also of the many global implications stemming from terrorism. Jan Schubert shares his impressive insight into an illicit flow with a global multi-billion dollar industry. As a member of the German State Police, he is working for the Federal Foreign Office in the field of international cooperation against drug trafficking, organized crime, human trafficking, piracy and corruption. He acts as a liaison officer to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, and for the EU Commission at the Attorney General's office in Cairo, he was combating illicit trafficking of cultural goods.
Illicit flow.
In the past, there have been looters all over ancient civilizations, and they were digging in archaeological sites or in pyramids, for example. They were digging for gold and diamonds and all other artifacts. But it was a one-man show, so to say. So they sold their cultural property to other people to gain money. It has been a business for thousands of years, but now it's a new dimension, especially if you got organized criminal networks dealing with cultural property for years now. They've gained so much wealth out of it. And I think the biggest difference is the degree of professionality. Law enforcement agencies have estimated 10 to 12 billion US dollars per year, which are made by illicit trafficking in cultural property. And on the art market, for example, there is a German study concerning the German art market 2015 to 2018. And there had been over 2,300 artifacts from Iraq and Syria, which were war regions in those times. There is no real number, but it's a small window through which you can see and you can estimate the whole amount of artifacts being on the art market. Auction houses sell those kind of artifacts legally. It's a big business, and not all the auction houses look very closely to the origin of those cultural goods. Everybody wants to make money with it. Most of the time, the buyers are collectors of artifacts, people who want to invest in art and cultural property. Maybe even museums buy from auction houses in goodwill, but not looking too closely. The classic modus operandi and supply chain would be, first of all, looting in regions of the global south. Most of the times, those are the poorest in the whole criminal supply chain. For example, farmers, and they just want more money to feed their children and their families. And this is a very unspecialized criminal actor, maybe near historical sites, and where authorities are simply not present or even corrupt. Then you need a central point for assessment and logistical preparations, cleaning processes, counterfeiting, and so on. These ones are a little bit more specialized, or even in criminal networks. And then you climb up this ladder on supply chain, and then you have more sophisticated criminal actions like the transportation, counterfeiting, forging documents, and you go up until you reach a certain position, which is mostly the seller on the legal art market who profits the most of all this illegal supply chain. The last step, it would be the European market, where legal and illegal goods sometimes merge. At the moment, we see big supply chains from regions of the global south, near and Middle East, or West Africa. Generally speaking, every region of crisis where authorities are not able to stabilize the region, where people suffer from poverty, from war, it opens a market for all kinds of illicit goods. So Europe is the region with the highest rate on auction houses, and all the money goes to the global north, to Europe. So it's a lose-lose business for the global south, and it's a win-win situation in a legal way for Europe, because you have the artifacts, you have the culture from the south, and now you have even the money made out of it.
Gray markets.
Gray area. A lack of public awareness is also true when it comes to the next illicit flow, the trafficking of Nigerian women to Europe for sexual exploitation. While the migration crisis of 2015 helped to shed more light on the subject, the actual problem is much older. There is a reason why, as early as 2012, Europol saw the necessity to form a pan-European approach to battle the trafficking of women and girls from Nigeria. This illegal trade has many intricate specifics that make it especially hard to combat. One of them is the integration of an age-old spiritual world to literally cast a spell on young women. But there are also several points at which the trafficking chain overlaps with the legal sphere, as Dr. Judith Vorrath explains. She is senior associate at the SWP, specializing on organized crime and security policies, and also one of the editors. In her recent paper, she examines this form of human trafficking and uncovers how illegal trade routes are connected to both Nigeria's pre-colonial history and the introduction of Christian faith to the African continent.
...16% of women trafficked to Europe are from West Africa. That's a number some years old, but that's actually quite a significant number. Most of the women and also the perpetrators in this flow actually come from one specific area in Nigeria, the south, mostly Edo State. Women are recruited on the ground, and then they are kind of forced to undergo a ritual called the juju, and that kind of binds them to their traffickers. They are so-called juju priests, and usually women have to give some of their hair, nails or whatever, and there's an oath, and they are told if you don't obey the orders of your traffickers, basically, if you want to get out of this arrangement, there will be serious consequences. You could also say it's almost like a curse, and this consequence can be for you, but also for your relatives. From what we know, I think the most common scheme really is that underage girls, even or women from this particular area in the south, are recruited. People they often know and trust ask them to go to, for example, Europe for work. And they don't know this will be prostitution. They think it is working at a home or working in the service industry in another way. Often there's also quite a bit of pressure from the parents or their social environment to actually do this. And it's a promising thing for people who come also sometimes from poor areas. Once they arrive in Europe, they realize that they are there for sexual exploitation. They're also told then that they have to repay their debts for traveling and for living expenses. They don't have their passport or proper papers. So the deal also changes once they arrive, and they then are really forced to stay with their traffickers and exploiters. Some women arriving in Europe have also been recruited in migrant reception or detention centers. So it's also certainly linked to migration. Some women are also sold to traffickers in Libya, for example, and then they are brought to Europe in a similar scheme. And once they arrive, they're usually handled by so-called madams who are acting like pimps, and they've usually been working the sex business themselves and been trafficked. It used to be that they are also taking care of recruitment and facilitating the trafficking itself. But it seems that in recent years, other Nigerian groups that are more organized and violent have been moving into the business, and the madams have been kind of replaced. But in some countries, it's still the scheme that they are making sure that they stay in the business and do what they're supposed to do. The big question indeed is, why are so many women who are trafficked coming from Edo State and the surrounding states in southern Nigeria? And the perpetrators, more or less. There is not one reason, and of course there's no proof for one explanation, but there is an indication in the way that the slave trade in pre-colonial times used to be most elaborate in the southeast, and when it was prohibited by the British, it went underground, so basically it became illegal. It was shifting from trading in men to children. But also by the 1930s, there was a type of trafficking emerging or becoming public. That was Nigerian women working in prostitution. This was reported by Nigerians saying there are women who have several other women under their control who work in the sex business. So apparently this business model had emerged already at the time. And then by 1980, it kind of moved on to Italy. It was mostly that people from the south came to Rome for pilgrimage in the 80s increasingly, and it was quite easy to travel at the time for Nigerians. And women started to engage in kind of petty trade with fabrics and clothes, taking them home. And when it got more difficult in the business environment, they discovered that they could also work in the sex business while in Italy. Once they had established that business, they were kind of protecting their business environment and became recruiters for further women to move to Italy. And so it kind of became a more criminal type of business. The girls and women in prostitution in European countries, they face dire conditions. First of all, they are threatened to pay back the debts, to keep working, to earn money as much as possible. They are living in very simple conditions. The traffickers are not interested in making their living conditions very comfortable. Apparently, it's a scheme that it's good if you have women who apply for asylum for two reasons. They can stay for some time for the application to be handled, and then also they are actually provided for in the centers where they live. There's been a lot of prevention efforts in Nigeria to actually let women know about the dangers and let people in the environment know about it. But apparently this hasn't stopped the problem. One point that's always on the table when we talk about illicit flows is kind of legalizing aspects of the activities we're talking about, because the demand will probably not go away anytime soon. So there is always the option to channel the business in a different way. Legalizing prostitution, that's already to some extent a reality in some countries. It's ambivalent at best, but at least having safer legal ways of migration is also a way, because the trafficking itself has become more dangerous. If you want to address the root causes, it's not just preventing women from entering the deal, kind of, or the arrangement, or believing that they will be working in a good job in Europe, but it also really is about, you know, giving people other opportunities.
The Nigerian case is a good example of how something started out as a legal business, then became illegal at some point, to ultimately turn into organized crime. Our last example features a material that everybody knows, gold. It is not an illegal substance and mostly traded on legal markets. And yet, there are countries like South Africa where this valuable mineral is at the core of a complicated web of social dependencies and criminal activity. The closer we look, the more difficult it becomes to draw clear boundaries between legal and illegal activities. In addition, we cannot even say that prohibiting the illegal activities around gold mining in South Africa would necessarily improve the situation. This is especially true where artisanal mining is involved, a rather basic and mostly manual process. Dr. Melanie Müller is a senior associate at SWP, concerned with the situation in Southern Africa, and the head of a research project investigating transnational supply chains of metals. She's also one of the editors of the publication on illicit flows.
South Africa is among the 10 biggest gold producers in the world. Most of the mining is industrial mining. Artisanal mining is not really legalized, so that means it's very difficult to understand how much of the mine that it's been produced in South Africa actually comes from artisanal mining. But I think most of the time, especially what I've seen, it's men who sometimes work alone, but very often work together in a cooperative or in bigger groups. They start digging small holes, they take the gold out and then work together. You just, you know, extract the gold and then you sell it into a normal market. Artisanal mining is not per se illegal. You know, it can be recognized as official practice and then the government handed out licenses to artisanal miners, so they just became normal operators, so to say, and that was officially recognized. In South Africa, it's very often migrant workers who work in this field. It's people who normally struggle to find legal employment. That means they are very vulnerable and then become exploited. But at the same time, of course, it gives them an opportunity to earn money. Very often, artisanal mining has been done in former industrial mining sites. You can only exhaust a certain degree, and sometimes there are leftovers of gold, and then artisanal miners go there and dig for that, because it's not profitable for a company anymore to do that in an industrial process because it would become so expensive. One problem in South Africa is that many mines, not only gold mines, but also others, have not been adequately rehabilitated. So that means normally you would close a mine, there's a certain closing procedure, and then it wouldn't be easy to go and dig for gold anymore. The problem is that so far artisanal mining is happening in illegal ways because criminal networks have formed around artisanal mining, and it's also connected to corrupt networks in the society. There's been a lot of violence in the South African mining sector, especially in artisanal mining, conflicts between different criminal networks, because of course they compete for beneficial mining sites. For certain communities, it has problematic consequences, but it is also accepted sometimes. South Africa has a very high unemployment rate, officially 30%, but in rural areas it's much higher. Imagine you have, for example, 100 workers coming to a small town. They need food, they need water, they need shelter. That might create additional jobs. So the argument is if you would formalize it, you could regulate the negative aspects in a much better way. A European buys gold from a South African seller, gold that had been refined and smelted in South Africa and then further processes so that you eventually can buy your ring in a shop in Berlin, so to say. That is another area of the supply chain. There are a couple of companies that sell fair trade gold or ecologically labeled gold. We have different certificates. So if you would, for example, want to get married and you want to buy a fair trade gold ring, you can actually do that. There's one regulation in the European Union that's actually very important. It's the EU Conflict Minerals Regulation. And that forces European companies, if they buy gold somewhere in the world, to look at the conditions where the gold comes from. They have to check that the gold does not come from an area that is either confronted with a conflict, and also that the gold does not come from illegal practices. So companies have to carry out a lot of research before they can actually buy something. And the European Commission has already announced that they will go much further and include other metals, because now it's only four metals, among them gold, and then regulate that area in a way that everything that we import has to come from fair conditions. Last but not least, that all depends on implementation. If companies don't implement it and they don't suffer any consequences, then we can have very nice laws in Germany or South Africa, but we don't achieve as much as we could. I think implementation is the big question.
This project brings together researchers from all over the globe, from Brazil to Brussels, from Albania to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Not all of them could be featured here in this podcast, but the international approach to the topic was a clear goal for the editors.
There is already a lot of good research out there investigating illicit flows in certain sectors and with certain goods. In our book, we would like to look at two factors. The first one is the intersection between the licit and the illicit economy. For example, at which stage of the supply chain does a good become legalized, or if it's an illegal good, which legal actors are involved. So this is the first big question. The second big question is the relationship between the global north and the global south. We know already a lot about illicit trade in the so-called global south, Africa, Latin America, Asia. But we don't know enough about the role of the global north, also the role of Europe. So what is happening after a drug has been produced in Latin America? How does it flow, so to say, to Europe? Which actors are involved? Which role do actors in the global north play? So that's the second big question to explore that relationship.
The different contributors and their topics illustrate once more. We live in a global economy with globally intertwined trade, and this equally applies to the legal and illegal flows of goods. So if policymakers and civil society seek to contain the negative outcomes of the illicit, what could be possible solutions? What can current research teach political decision makers?